You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series. Free speech, deplatforming, Patreon, and Sam Harris's response with Yaron Brook, Ankar Gatte, and Gregory Salmieri.
Welcome, everybody. And today I've got Ankar Gatte and Greg Salmieri with me, and we are taping this for the Ayn Rand Institute. We're going to both live stream this, and then it's going to be edited and used for videos on the Ayn Rand Institute channel. But we want to talk today about everything going on surrounding Patreon, but really this goes back to the debates that were going on about Facebook and the debates that were going on about Google. There's a new, I don't know if you guys know, but there's a new documentary coming out on Google that makes Google out to be this evil monster that is tracking everything we do and trying to control how we think. There's a lot of criticism. We're seeing it in Congress, we're seeing it from the political right, we're seeing it from the political left about social media, about Patreon. And all this is in the context of what's been going on campuses and a whole issue of free speech that's been going on for years now, certainly over the last 2 to 3 years in particular, 4 years in particular. And what I want to try to do today is first figure out, are they all connected? Is there a connection between all these two things? And where's this coming from? That is, what is the source? What is the origin for it? So I've got two philosophers here with me, so that's good, because I think as we'll be discussing, that the core of the problem here is philosophical, and the core of the issue is here philosophical. So earlier we were discussing some of what happened on Patreon, and Ankar, you said something. You said, why is anybody surprised? Or why should you be surprised about this? Talk a little bit about why you're not surprised by this and by everything else going on around the issue of free speech.
Yeah, I mean, you asked, are these issues interconnected? And I think the answer is yes. And when you look at the Patreon, so they came out then with a statement about why, particularly why they deplatformed or took off the service Sargon, Carl Benjamin. And they make reference to their community guidelines. And the community guidelines, what they quote, is about hate speech. So one of the quotes is, hate speech includes serious attacks or even negative generalizations of people based on their race and sexual orientation. Close quote. This, why I don't find it surprising, is that what these people learn in school, and particularly in colleges and universities, and the people leading the tech companies and involved in, I think, high-level decision-making in the tech companies are educated people, often in the U.S. from Ivy League schools. And if you're familiar with what is taught in regard to thinking about discrimination and hate speech, this is the kind of thing that is taught. And now they're trying to implement these policies in some kind of way that makes sense to them. Now, I think part of the way what one has to think about this whole issue is these kinds of standards about hate speech are, they're unclear. You cannot make sense of them. They don't provide the kind of guidance that people think that they do, that it includes serious attacks or even negative generalizations of people based on their race and sexual orientation. Part of the dispute in regard to Sargon is he was using these to defend himself against people who are characterized as alt-right or outright racist. And so he's not using these as generalizations to attack the people of a certain race or something. But there's all kinds of things you would have to think about if you're trying to figure out a real policy of this is the kind of conduct that we're expecting on our platform, the standards of communication, of language, of civility, that are very difficult to figure out. And it can vary from platform to platform, that some will be described more as the wild, wild west, and some will be described more as they have very elaborate rules about engagement and civility. And what happens, I think, is that they take over just from what they're taught in the universities, these kinds of and I think misconceptualization of what is permissible and what is not, and they're trying to apply them. And it's so it's this is what they've been taught. And in that sense, I don't find it surprising. It's not coming out of the blue. It has a long history if you know what is being taught on the university.
So, and even if they're not, even if they didn't go to university, because many of them are dropouts, right? These intellectual people, they read a lot of books. They you know, there's a story I read about Yuval Harari, this Israeli philosopher who's dreadful. But he's making the rounds in Silicon Valley and speaking to everybody, and everybody's reading his books. They're influenced by the intellectual culture surrounding us. So, Greg, what is it about the intellectual culture, the philosophical culture, the ideological culture that surrounds us that is leading to these confusions and to these errors or these evasions?
Well, there are a lot of things and they run very deep, but one of the more proximate causes, you know, not to go all the way down to irrationality, and we'll be blaming Plato, Jesus, and Kant, who I think do have their share of the blame. But the more proximate things is the notice the language of protected groups. So this is all thought of in terms of the way we're dealing with content policy is all a reaction against racism, sexism, anti-gay sentiment, and so forth. And we don't think of it in terms of a positive principle, but primarily in terms of certain groups get singled out as protected, and then there are special protections for them, and then we judge speech by whether it offends against those. And that's something that the good question as to where it comes from initially. One reason why it's so big in campus thinking about this, though I don't think this is the ultimate reason, is that it's a big part of the legal doctrine. So if you look at the Civil Rights Acts, right, this protected classes is important there. The Civil Rights Acts have a big role in education policy because, well, for a number of reasons, but it's incorporated into the rules by which universities have to govern themselves because they're receiving state funds. And so these kind of concepts of who are the protected groups, there's a legal regime around them. That legal regime, I think, has influenced the cultural regime. But I think, you know, there must be a deeper philosophical background for why the law went that way in the first place. I'm not sure where the language of thinking it in protected groups originally comes from specifically.
And now this protected group concept has morphed into this intersectionality where it's the, you know, it's a hierarchy of how oppressed your history has been.
Well, it's particularly intersectionality is you might be in several protected groups and, you know, and we have to understand. So that, I think, is a wider idea. So the idea of focusing on group identity and groups that have been persecuted in some way is wider than the particular protected groups relevant in policy. And that goes back to a kind of Marxist power struggle, class struggle influenced view of racial and sexual dynamics, which started to become a thing really in the 30s, but with the New Left, became a bigger and bigger deal in the 60s, 70s, and it's now in the intellectual mother's milk of a lot of the people who are teaching in a wide range of fields.
Okay.
Yeah, I think another important aspect of the roots of this, and thinking particularly of the philosophical roots of this, is what Ayn Rand called altruism. So the doctrine that you have to place others above self morally, and that your obligation and duty is to serve others, not your own self-interest and happiness. And you see this, one way I think that you can really see the play of this idea is there's been a lot of articles saying the Patreon does not, and other companies like Facebook and so on, do not apply their standards consistently across the board. And in regard to Patreon, it's been, look, they have communists on their platform who are talking about down with the whole capitalist class and the whole capitalist system and advocating the smashing of things. So advocating really bad ideas. And it's, well, if you're going to object to Sargon, why don't you object to this? And that, again, I think the answer is, what have people been taught in regard to these? It's, you can think of it, this is a variation on the idea that there's fascism versus communism, or the, and particularly the Nazis versus the communists. And we all know the Nazis are bad because they proclaim that they're strong and they're powerful and they're going to oppress the weak. That's how it's sort of held. And so everyone knows that's monstrous and vicious. And the communists there say that, oh no, we're out to help the weak. That's who we're concerned with. And so they're, that's, they have the moral sanction of a whole conventional morality that says that's what you're supposed to be doing. And so that both result in a sea of blood, they're nevertheless put in very different categories, because one is their moral idealist that somehow it's gone wrong. Some, but we all know that the slogan, from each according to his ability to each according to his need, that's a moral slogan. And we should be trying to implement that in some kind of way. So they don't put these people in the same category, even though they're advocating for destruction. And I mean, I don't want to put Sargon in these ads, but if you put real fascists, that they're advocating for destruction, and the neo-Nazis and so on, they don't put communists in that category. But why don't they put, and even though you can see, and it's established historically, the millions of bodies that have resulted from communism, and you need an explanation for that. And I think the explanation is philosophical and especially moral, not only moral, but it plays a crucial role.
Yeah, and I think even the hate speech, the idea behind hate speech, altruism plays a role in there, because hate speech almost always is targeted towards what's considered a weak or suffering or an oppressed group. And they have special, somehow, they have to be treated differently than everybody else. So, and the whole intersectionality, of course, is based on who suffers most. So altruism leads to creating special categories for people who need stuff. And our responsibility is to sacrifice to those who need. So the more you need, the more we all should accommodate you. And I think hate speech is partially, the idea of hate speech is partially driven by that. And the whole attitude towards certain groups is structured like that. Greg, you look like you want to say something.
Yeah, it's a sort of a difficult issue, because when a group is in fact being mistreated, as is the case or has been at different times, it is now with racial minorities, sexual minorities, but also, as Ayn Rand insisted, with business people, right? So when a group is a subject of persecution, it's right to be sensitive to negative language about that group, to not tolerate it, to know that, oh, here's this popping up again. So the fact that someone has been a victim or is typically a victim of a type of thing, there's a reason to be more sensitive about them. But what's, and in exactly how to think about that reason and prioritize it and put it in the hierarchy with the other things that go into our determining what our policy should be or who we want to associate with, is a question that requires thought. But what you have in the kind of current progressive, if you want to call it that, mindset on this is a super privileging of that kind of reason, a making of the victim status the kind of central thing that you have to think about in how to deal with people. And this is something Ayn Rand talked about a long time ago in The Age of Envy. This is really, she's seeing this all starting to come about, a kind of over concern or a phrasing everything in terms of concern for various real or allegedly put upon groups, or if not put upon, groups that are in some way needy, or you know, maybe they're handicapped or whatever it is, and an orienting of everything and all of our rules of discussion and engagement around them. So it is right, I think, that it's particularly insensitive, particularly nasty or whatever, to make comments about, you know, people who are badly off through no fault of their own. But if you make making sure that those people never face that, the be all and end all of your what you're thinking about in determining content policy and elevating it above, for example, the needs of the people who are determining policy and bringing the culture and you know, trying to think through and reach the truth about issues, above their needs to be able to consider all the different options and viewpoints, then I think you're there's a real hierarchy inversion there. There's a real sacrificing of the kind of intellectual environment needed to pursue truth, including to consider scary and heterodox alternative views, to a legitimate but now exaggerated concern about offending or hurting or dispossessing in some way people who have been mistreated.
Okay.
Yeah, I think this is, it's an important aspect of altruism to get this, and it's part of why Ayn Rand was so vehemently opposed to this moral viewpoint. It's the altruism encourages you to not pay attention to why someone lacks a value. So the way she would put it, it elevates the lack of a value to, that's your, one of the ways she puts it in Atlas Shrugged, that's your pass key to the moral elite. This is what gives you the moral superiority from which you can now make demands on other people. And it's very important if you're dealing with people who lack a value because they've been subject to injustice, persecution, slavery, that it's really, really bad that happened to them. And it's understandable why they might lack a value. And you should be, if you're have a value orientation, you should be really concerned with that. But the idea that someone in a capitalist system is a victim of Bill Gates or Steve Jobs because they wouldn't give him a break and he doesn't want to work, he just wants handouts and so on. And well, look, he also doesn't have a value. So he has the same status as a Jewish person who was persecuted by the anti-Semitics, or a Black who was enslaved in the 19th century. That's monstrous to put these people in the same category and that you have to deal with them in the same way. And part of the pushback, I think, against political correctness is a sense that something's wrong with what I would call this, and following Ayn Rand, a package deal of putting things into a package that don't belong together. There's a kind of rebellion that this is wrong and I don't have to treat all the people in the same way, which is true, but then they don't separate out that, okay, but there are real victims of injustice and there are people who lack a value because of their own either lack of effort or error or outright evil in the choices that they're making. And you need to pull that apart. And altruism encourages you never to think about that issue. But if you're moral, if you're really concerned with morality, values, the pursuit of happiness, you have to think about that and make that distinction.
And we should add a third category too. So there's the people who lack a value because they've been treated unjustly. There's the people who lack a value because they've not earned it. They should have, and they've been immoral. And then there's the third group of people who just lack a value through some kind of bad luck. They, you know, were born with a handicap, lightning struck them or whatever. But all three of these are put together, and they deserve different kinds of treatment.
Now, to what extent do you think this disregard of reason, critical thinking, because a lot of this boils down to people not thinking right about these issues or not thinking. And particularly with regard to the hate speech, and particularly with regard to a lot of this kind of, there's so much emotionalism out there. There's so much, there's almost an elevation of somebody's emotion, with the micro triggering and the microaggressions and all these kind of things. To what extent do you think it has to do with just a disrespect for the mind and a disrespect for reason?
I mean, it's a little bit hard to really understand what's going on with the, you know, so-called triggering and microaggressions culture. And I suspect it's different in different places. So I've been surprised by how little of that kind of thing I've encountered teaching at a university. I taught a class where it was a class on critical thinking. And I thought, you know, you can't think critically and you're not practicing unless you're doing it on the issues that are going to get you upset. So I did this twice, and I took surveys of like, what issues are you guys most upset about and think the people who hold the other side is evil about? And I tried to get a mix of them where, you know, some students would think the others were bad on each issue and it wouldn't always be the same student. And, you know, I said, you know, we're making this class a safe space for discussing the difficult issues. And in the sense of, you know, anyway, and the the students were all fine with it. And then some of them occasionally said the others were bad on something. And it, you know, they, so I don't think students are as fragile as by and large as we're made to think they are, at least not at most universities, but, or at least not at the ones I've taught at. But, you know, there clearly are these cases where there's, I think, a minority, but people who get really feel a need and a moral authority granted to them by this ideology that we've been talking about to say that because they're part of this group, their desires and needs trump others. And I think it is a kind of a desire to exert power over people that they see as justified by the fact that they're part of a group that power has been exerted upon unjustly. And it all comes from this kind of viewing the world in terms of groups in power struggle conflicts. So that's where I think that comes from. And you see it, you know, it's been a dominant, or it's been a major factor in the way the left thinks about politics for a long time. And I think you see it also in the way some rightists think about politics, who see themselves as a put upon or dispossessed group.
All right. I think there's an element. I get what you're picking up, Yaron, and you often bring this up, that there's a real emotionalism. I think there is an element that students are too much encouraged that to take their emotions as a given, not analyzable. They're part of who they are. It's expression of their identity. Who are you to say that I've got my emotion is off in some kind of way? There's an element of that that is they're not analytical. They're not encouraged to be self-reflective enough. But I would not paint all or even the majority of the students like that. And I think that's important. Greg was touching on this about the moral dynamics involved. I find the Evergreen State College episode, and if you watch what's caught on tape, very revealing for what is happening on campus and sort of the dynamic and the struggles. Because even if you're talking just about the students, there were better students. There were students of Weinstein's who were trying to defend him, who were trying to, as he was trying to engage with the student protesters and actually talk to them and have a real conversation. Some of the students were trying, and the sort of militant ones, but it's moral militancy. It's that they feel like they're right. Nobody can question this. I'm saying we're victims, and that's the end of the argument. There's a stridency there, and people don't know how to oppose it, and they're intimidated. And then they will say they're the representatives of all students and every enlightened voice on campus. They're not. But part of the Evergreen State College episode, what is interesting about it is, I mean, Brett Weinstein will talk about that he will get private emails and so on of people in support and from the faculty and so on, but they won't speak out publicly for risk of the blowback, losing their positions, or maybe losing their positions. And if you watch some of the film of the students engaging with the administration, and you think in a moral term, who's running the university? It's this militant band of students, but it's because they feel like they have the moral high ground. And unless you're gonna confront this issue at a moral level, I don't think you can really confront it. And I think some of the best of the people in the so-called intellectual dark web, part of what gives them their power that people rightly look and respect it is that they make a moral stand, like a Peterson or a Harris or a Brett Weinstein, is that no, this is morally unacceptable. I'm not going to be intimidated by this. And it is part, I mean, the whole dynamic here is one of intimidation, and I'm going to name that. And more people have to be willing to do that. But it's so I don't think we're dealing with a majority of students, but we're dealing with a minority who are supported by voices in the faculty as well, that think that there's no moral opposition to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's true that it's a minority, but it's obviously an influential minority, because we're seeing at least some of that attitude come into the, you know, the service agreement of Patreon and into Facebook and into these places because they have the moral high ground, right? So And that's the problem, some of the problem with the intellectual dark web. While they're morally opposed to it, they don't have a moral alternative to it. That is, they can't state what would be an, so they want the same morality, just construed very differently, but it's basically the same fundamental moral code. And so I think that that's the same thing. You go to Silicon Valley, where I think people are intelligent, they're smart, they're thinking, they're obviously they're producing, they can't produce without thinking. And they can't oppose even the elements within them who are more radical, because they have no alternative to offer. Because they don't have an alternative moral code. Yeah, Greg.
So if you look at the people in the intellectual dark web who have been better on this, right, who have more had a moral tone and garnered an audience for that reason precisely, because there are a number of different reasons why these different figures have attracted followings, right? They tend to be, and the ones I think are better of them, tend to be the ones who do have more of a moral alternative. It might not be the right one, and it's not deeply enough an alternative, but they have articulate views on morality. So if you look at Sam Harris, he's basically a philosopher and a moral theorist, and he's a kind of utilitarian, basically. And so he has a kind of Millian-like view of this. And that view, I think, has a lot wrong with it and ultimately would lead to these kinds of views. But it's a much earlier generation of it. It's like, Leonard Peikoff distinguishes between the D1s and the D2s. There's the kind of version of a view that's fully embraced what's bad about it and a version that still has real elements of what's good. It's a more moderate version. And so you could see Sam Harris is in a position to make, I think, pretty good moral stand sometimes because of this. And Peterson's, an interesting character but he's somebody who's thoughtful about issues of morality. And you can see that in how he comes out about that. I'm not sure that he has a moral theory exactly that I'd know how to classify, but he's somebody who's and that's just because I have not read enough of him on that. He may very well have one. But he's not, but he's someone who's consistently thoughtful about moral issues. And so it's not a surprise that these are the ones who are able to take the most articulate moral stands on when these kind of issues come up.
Okay, so I want to bring it back to the Patreon, Facebook situation. And we talked a little bit about, we talked before the show, we talked a little bit about the real challenge that these companies face. That is, when you create a platform, any kind of platform, you have a concert hall and you decide who you're going to invite to give speeches, and you decide, no, I'm not going to accept that neo-Nazi rally, but I am going to accept, this singer, but I won't accept that singer. Or there have been cases where the Metropolitan Opera has put on a opera that was deemed anti-Semitic, and there was a lot of discussion about should they or shouldn't they sanction, shouldn't they put on their stage this particular opera. At the Institute, we have to decide who's going to be on the stage at a conference that we're holding. Patreon, at the end of the day, has to have some standards at who they'll allow to use their platform. Facebook, is not going to apply. You're not going to allow explicit pornography. It's not going to allow ISIS, I think everybody agrees, to recruit on there. Should they allow neo-Nazis? Should they allow communists? It's complicated. And where do you draw the line, and who's what? And so talk a little bit about the issues that arise from the fact that you have to choose. I mean, this is one of the things that objectivism, right, is very strong about. We have to choose. And this is what Patreon, I think a lot of these companies originally thought they wouldn't have to choose, and they're getting to the point where they have to make decisions. They have to select. Why is this hard? Why is this complicated? Even if you had a rational philosophy, I think it would be hard, but certainly in the world in which we live in today, why is it so hard? Anka?
Yeah, I wanted to say something about the positive point here before going a lot into all the complications and why it's hard. And that's that the idea of who you said you have to choose, the idea of who you choose to associate with is a really important issue in life. And it's an important issue professionally of who you're going to work with, who you want to hire, on what terms. It's important personally of who do you view as good and bad? Who are your friends, and who are the people in the wider culture that you oppose because of either their actions or their views? And if you're taking values seriously, you want to be on the side of the people who are pro values, and you want to oppose in legitimate ways the people who are not on the side of values. And when you associate with someone, whether even if you say, it doesn't mean anything, the very act of associating with something has real implications. It means that you view this person as worthy of associating with. And all kinds of bad people, they're seeking cover, and they're seeking that people will think they're better than they otherwise are. What allows them to, in various kinds of ways, defraud people. It's because people don't recognize that they're not good. And when good people associate with bad people, you elevate the status of bad people. Even if you say, well, I oppose Nazis, but every day you go out for the beer with them, it's like, do you really oppose? That's a real question. Do you really oppose it? And if you're pro-values, this matters a lot to you to think about this issue. And then it's difficult to work it out in all its details, but it's an issue that matters and is significant. And I think it's important to get that.
Yes, no, absolutely. And Greg, about this, some of the complexities and how do you do it?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing that I'd want to say even before getting to that is just to stress that this is a distinct issue from freedom of speech, right? So the freedom of speech means that people can say what they want without somebody answering them by force. So you can't shut someone up by beating them up. You can't take their property because they said something you want. If somebody has a television show and makes fun of the president can't then pull them into court for making fun of him, as our current president, America hater as he is, wants to do. Rather, so that's what free speech means. And it also means that if I make fun of your profit, you can't shoot me for doing it, right? So both private gangs acting by force and the government acting by force can't stop me from speaking. And the government can't turn a blind eye if private citizens start lynching abolitionists or uppity black people, quote uppity as they would put it, or if Islamist terrorist groups start shooting up magazines or just appearing, you know, holding weapons and trying to intimidate people out of speaking, right? So that's what freedom of speech means. It means people can't exercise force on you to stop you from speaking. It doesn't mean that other people have to help you speak by giving you a television station, by giving you an internet platform, by making YouTube and letting you broadcast on it, or by making Patreon and letting you fund your broadcast through it. Right? Those are not freedom of speech issues. I mean, it's really important to separate them out. Those are association issues. And the freedom of speech and the freedom of association are aspects of the same freedom, intellectual freedom, the liberty to lead our lives by the guidance of our minds and to go where our thinking takes us and then act accordingly. Right? And that freedom demands that YouTube and Facebook and Patreon are free to exclude whoever the hell they want. Now, the next question, though, and that we are free to exclude people we don't want to talk to and not invite them to our conferences or not appear on panels with them, right, as we do, right? But then the question is, given that we have this freedom and should have this freedom and fight to preserve this freedom, right, then how should we exercise it? Who do we want to associate with? And it's not a binary of you either, you're best friends with someone and you associate with them in every way, or you shun them and you'll never be in the same room with them. There's who do you want to associate in what ways, on what terms? I appear, you know, there are people I'd appear on a panel with, but I wouldn't co-teach a class with or co-author a paper with, or people I wouldn't appear on a panel with, but I would be in the same room with them. And there are people I'd leave the room if they walked in, right? There are all kinds of different terms. Now, how do you make those decisions? And how does an organization make those decisions? Well, first of all, it's difficult, right? So it's not obvious in all the cases. You have to know, if you're applying it to a particular case, like facts about the person, and that takes time and work to do. If you're talking about building a policy, then you have to think about what your purpose is. And I think different organizations should have different policies having to do with their different purposes. So the Ayn Rand Institute, for example, its purpose is to, I forget the exact words in the mission statement, but you know, advance or spread the philosophy of objectivism. That requires a different standards for, say, who will be a teacher there than a college university, which isn't trying to spread a particular ideology, but is trying to increase the general level of knowledge and education in a culture. And different than an organization like, say, the Ford Hall Forum, which is trying to promote a discourse on issues, I think, issues of public note. And so they want to have as wide a range of opinions there as is possible. And we have a much wider range than I think certainly ARI would have, or even than I think maybe a university should have. So there are different organizations with different purposes. And you have to think about that in if you're an organization creating a policy. What kind of organization are we building? What do we want this platform to be? And therefore, what are our policies going to be? And then you also have to think a policy that you can't enforce in a coherent way is not a policy worth having. So if you need to know more about people to judge whether they're in or out of this policy than you can find out, or easily find out, or find out with the resources you have, then that's not a good policy. And there are just a lot of things that need to be worked out. And I don't envy Facebook or Patreon or YouTube the job of working out what their content policy should be. And it, the right reaction to them is not anger. Now, it might be at Patreon in this case only because a lot of Patreon's prominent creators are using Patreon precisely because they're concerned about issues of finding a platform where they can fund speech that's very controversial. And the CEO of the company had reached out to them in the past trying to give them assurances about how these things should be handled. And then they were blindsided by what happened. And for that reason, those people, I think, have a right to be angry. And whether or not they're angry, I think it's very reasonable of them. And I really applaud Sam Harris in particular for his statement and what he said and didn't say about it, right? To saying, look, I don't think I can trust this platform to be a source of my revenue. And I think he didn't say they're evil people or they're censoring me or stifling my speech. He said, I don't have the kind of confidence in how they're making these decisions that I feel like I want to deal with them this way. And if I were him, I would do the same thing. And I know, Yaron, you're thinking about how you want to deal with them.
Well, and that's another aspect of the freedom of association, right? I mean, Sam Harris has the ability to leave if he does not want to associate now with Patreon, just as Patreon has the right to not associate with Sam Harris or Carl Benjamin, whoever it decides not to associate with.
Essentialist is asking us, or essentialist, kind of clever pun, who's also been complaining that we don't know more about Jordan Peterson than I said we did before, is now making a point that is worth our talking about on the ARI Facebook or YouTube chat. He's saying that a lot of these companies have benefited from government help. Maybe it's not really a free market here. This isn't his word, but maybe they're in effect government utilities or something like that, and we have to think about them differently. What do you guys make of that idea?
I mean, I think it's a very, very dangerous idea, and I think it's very wrong. If that were the case, then every business in the United States would be basically a subsidiary of the government, and you would have to treat them all. And the fact that we use public roads and the fact that we use government services could be. So I think you can't just say that if they got, I don't know, they use the internet, which was at some point down the road, made possible through public funds and the university system. I mean, of all the industries in the United States, technology is the freest. It's the least, it gets the least benefits from government. It's the least hand in hand with government. It's the least crony of all of them. But you can't blame them for the fact that government is in all of our lives and it's in every aspect of it. You can't therefore make them now, it would make every one of us as individuals now actors of the government, agents of the government. It makes it all agents of the government, which is a very scary and I think it's not a very helpful way to think about the world, and it's wrong.
Yeah, I mean, a way of putting that same point is you can identify a problem, but if your solution is more of the same problem, you have to really think, are you trying to identify the problem, or have you already identified it, that I hate Facebook or I hate YouTube and I want the government to do something about it. And now here's an argument that I found that will make that semi-legitimate, that we're going to take over Facebook. We're going to start dictating to YouTube what its policies have to be. Because if you really thought, look, there's government involvement in Facebook. They've been involved in funding some of the research and so on. And I don't think that's legitimate. The solution is to be an advocate of for more separation between the government and the economy, not for the government. Let's hand it one more power over the economy. And so I'm sympathetic to some, and we were talking about this earlier, because with Patreon, there's issues, some of the backstory, we don't know really, I think, if it's true or not, but that some of the big financial processing firms, PayPal, MasterCard, are behind. We don't want to be, they're saying, those companies are saying, we don't want to be associated with this. So either we're going to reconsider our relationship with you, Patreon, or you do something about these people. And the financial industry, so you said the internet, these internet companies and social media are among the freest, the least, where there's government attempt to control how they act and behave. The financial industry is one of the most controlled industries where government dictates everything. And there's reasons to be worried about that. But again, the solution is not, okay, so government has to take over Facebook and YouTube. It's the solution is, look, we've got a huge problem in our economy because the government has its hands on the financial system, which spreads into all these other businesses and has all kinds of effects and repercussions that are almost impossible to trace fully what is going on. And even the people involved don't always know, am I doing this as a business decision, but or because I'm worried about government and my relationship with them? And they sort of hinted that if you do this, we probably won't like it, but they haven't outright said, if you do that, we're going to descend. And you're trying to figure out how to act. And it's a real problem. But the solution is not, okay, let's hand more power to government.
Absolutely. And these are the kind of problems that you're going to get in a mixed economy. I mean, Ayn Rand talked about this all the time, about all the problems that a mixed economy creates, and the gangs and this pressure groups, and it's this group versus that group, and who's doing what. But the solution can't be to, as you said, to increase government power and to increase the government intervention and to make the economy even more mixed. The solution has to be to move us towards more freedom in one way or another. So any proposal that involves giving government more power has to be dismissed, even if it turns out that there's government influence on what's going on in the background.
So since I mentioned essentialist before as having raised this, I should say he's agreeing with much of what we've been saying here. And he says he's not advocating for the government doing that. So I think he does raise a good question. And but the solution to it is, as we say, pulling back the...
I worry about the fact, though, that because I hear this objection a lot, I worry about the fact that people overestimate how much government is involved. It's involved way too much, way, way too much. But by doing that, they underestimate the genius and the work and the achievement of these companies. I mean, we're all doing this. We're live streaming now on 4 different platforms, I think, chatting with you all live because these companies exist. I mean, this just 5 years ago, this would have been impossible. Maybe even 3 years ago would have been impossible. And this isn't some government conspiracy that allows us to do this. This is the genius of people working hard in Silicon Valley to do it. And they might all be a bunch, you know, they might all be philosophically very confused and politically really bad. But look what they're doing. And we shouldn't forget, like, the productive genius that is making all this possible, because there's a mixed economy out there. They do this in spite of the mixed economy, and in some senses, it makes it even more heroic.
Yeah, and they're the ones who are being let down by the intellectuals.
Yeah.
So Mark Zuckerberg and whoever, you know, I forget who started YouTube. It wasn't Google, and then they bought it. But, you know, whoever, the people who started these companies, most of them weren't in it to create content companies or control what people talk to, even were particularly interested in setting content policies. The guy who started Patreon, right, started it because he was a musician who wanted to find more ways to fund the arts and so forth. And these people had goals. They were legitimate goals, real values for communities they wanted to create. They were really great creators who created these platforms, attracted a lot of people to them. And at a certain point, they found, boy, we're out of our depth here. We're having to deal with a whole lot of kinds of issues about what to permit and what not to permit. I know we can't have ISIS on, but then who else do we ban if we ban them? And how do we do it? And how do we enforce it? And they turn to the places in society where you're meant to be able to get answers for these kind of things. And they get a lot of confusing crap. And some of it they agree with, some of it they don't agree with, but the division of labor is such that they should be able to produce what they produce and then call on the intellectuals to help them and be able to have the society helping them find the better intellectuals. Where if you go to the top universities, you don't find people who are going to be giving the right messages on this, right? So it's a really difficult situation. These people are among the victims of the fact that we have an intellectual culture that doesn't have good answers to these, or good answers aren't prevalent. And then I want to stress also, it's not like I know all the answers. It's not like the right answers are obvious and only people who have the right philosophy could see them all. I think better philosophy is a kind of necessary condition to doing it, but I don't know what YouTube's content policy should be. And I don't think, you know, you'd have to be someone who really thought a lot about it in light of the right philosophical principles. It's a real achievement that hasn't yet been achieved. And it's not, you know, the CEOs have to work with what they can work with. You know, they can't do everything.
So let me ask you, where do you think, this is going culturally? And because this is really becoming when these platforms happen, it's becoming a newsworthy event. It's becoming a cultural phenomenon. Do you think this is heading it's going to get worse and worse and worse? Do you think there's going to be a rebound? Do you think we're going to get any kind of clarity?
My worry, I'm very worried about this. From the two directions. So the kind of moral intimidation of these companies and the political intimidation of the countries, and they're intertwined. But as an example of the moral intimidation and why, to go back to what we were talking about early on, that this comes from the universities and what they've been teaching. I mean, so there's a letter, I forget what the title of it is, but addressed to Mark Zuckerberg from a bunch of organizations that promote themselves as, we're just acting in the, I think they use public good or common good, and you've been abusing your power and we've been trying to tell you how you should be acting and how to implement hate speech policies and so on, and we're just looking out for people's civil rights, so we're the moral people. You're the grubby businessman who's just out for a buck, and we've been trying to tell you to shape up, and you haven't been. And this is pushed from grade school to the universities, this kind of position that it's evil to make profits. You should be looking out for a victim. It doesn't matter if they're a victim of injustice or a victim of their own errors or really bad choices. You're not to pay attention to any of that. We're to dictate. We're to morally dictate to you how you should be acting. And it's very hard. Part of what Greg was talking about, the failure of the intellectuals. People should be championing these massive creators of the whole, of this whole new era in information technology, and trying to help them create even greater value rather than trying to run them morally in the muck. And then that makes possible that people after political power sense that there no one will come to their moral defense of people like this. It makes it easier for them to go after them politically. And the idea of watching Zuckerberg and some of the Twitter Dorsey. Yeah. Dragged in front of the halls of Congress, it should remind you of these kinds of show trials in authoritarian dictatorships. They're being attacked, and it's important that they were being attacked by the so-called left, the Democrats, and the so-called right.
Nobody comes to their defense.
Yes, I've never been a fan of Ted Cruz, but his grilling of Mark Zuckerberg about has there been any conservatives deplatformed? Has there any been on the other side and so on? And all with this ominous, the power of the gun of the government behind him, that we don't like what you're doing. We're going to take control of this. And people think of Ted Cruz as a defender of freedom of speech. This was such an attack on freedom of speech that the companies can't set their own policies, and or if it's policies that the government disapproves of, then the government gets to set the policies. And so if you have this lack of moral appreciation, no moral defense, outright moral attacks on these companies, and then people after political power on every side sensing this and pouncing, it's we're not in a good situation.
Very scary. Greg?
Yeah, I think these are the companies that are in the crosshairs. Someone online is saying it's gotten to the point that if you're interested in profit, people act like you're bad or you're looked down upon. But that's not getting to that point. It's been that way for 100 years. But it's become more and less intense at different times. And it's intensifying. And these particular companies who had been closer to people appreciating their virtue. People loved them a few years ago. There were certain CEOs who were celebrities. Certainly Apple Jobs was when he was alive, right? These were companies that were semi-partially exempt from the hatred against profit seekers, and who were seen as idealistic, and some small tiny percent of the kind of attitude that we ought to have towards business heroes, the culture had towards these these particular ones as a rare exception. And now they're being turned on, and they're being turned on by everybody, and they require defense. So that's, the main thing. I think we need moral defense of the major internet companies, and that is Amazon, Google, and Facebook, maybe some others, but those are Twitter. Those are the ones that come most to mind. And then the other issue culturally is what's going to happen with regard to these kind of association policies and things. Well, I was really heartened by the reactions of Peterson and Rubin on the one hand and Harris on the other to the Patreon event. And what I was, and this I primarily give Peterson and Harris credit for this, more than Rubin, who I like actually quite a lot, but I think it's Harris and Peterson in whom we saw less anger and hostility and betrayal, although there was some of that, and more boy, this is a problem that needs to be solved. What are the what should the policies be? Yoram, when you were commenting on the clip of Peterson and Rubin talking, you on one of your shows said you were interested to see that they talked about, they were having debates about what the content policies should be. Yeah. And the fact that they're recognizing that there is a problem here to be solved. It's not some super obvious thing. Oh, we'll just do what John Stuart Mill says in On Liberty and it'll be fine. Rather there's real, it needs to be thinking about what the policy should be. And I think these are some smart people who have some of the right ideas, not all the way down, but at approximate level, they're all people who have some respect for reason and respect for the need for a discourse on a range of issues with a range of positions to get ideas out there. And hopefully that will lead them to come up with a platform that has some better policies and that it'll take off. That I think is a hopeful sign. I think it's too early days to know because it is a really hard problem, but that's, a bright spot in this.
And let me just, we'll end with this final question because you brought up Harris and Jude. What is your guys' assessment of this whole intellectual dark web phenomena and these voices that have risen over the last 2-3 years to oppose some of the attempts to clamp down on speech on campuses and on some of these platforms? Uncle.
Overall, I have a positive, a very positive reaction and evaluation of it, because I think it's, I don't always agree with their ideas, just they wouldn't agree with mine. But I think there's a real seriousness about ideas and a real interest in discussion. And discussion isn't, there are people who it's not worth discussing things with, but if you have a serious idea that there's ground rules for discussion and you're supposed to be making arguments and you're supposed to have evidence behind them and you should listen when people are saying, well, no, that doesn't make sense to me. And what about this kind, have you, do you, this kind of example, this kind of observation. And if it's the context really is a genuine attempt to know and to discover what is right and what is true, that's what real discussion is. So it's not discussion for discussion's sake. It's discussion on a quest for knowledge and truth. And I think they're actually, the majority of them are interested in it. Even when I disagree with it, they're interested in knowledge, they're interested in truth and the means to get there. I do think there's an issue of association here that isn't, I mean, and there's stories about the intellectual dark web where who exactly are the members of this? And there was, I think, a New York Times story about this. And well, they have some of these sort of very questionable people with questionable views, and they all think of themselves as part of this. And I think it's important not to think of it as one monolithic group. And it's important that the people who are either self-identifying in it or being classified in it, they take seriously this issue of who is proper to associate with and on what terms, and who is not a proper person to associate with. And just the fact that you don't like the mainstream doesn't mean you have something in common, actually. It's something fundamental or deep in common with people. And it's important. That's an important issue. And it's, again, it's the difference between the issue of freedom of speech and the positive of what are your grounds for associating with people and why?
Yeah, I have the same positive reaction and the same concerns. When the name got coined and started getting used, I got more concerned. I don't think it's a good name. And I think the fact that it's from Eric Weinstein, I think, is one of the Weinsteins. And he's the, if you listen to him talk about why they need to band together and have a name and the way in which they're a political tribe, I think some of what he says is good, but I think there's a lot bad in that. And I think he's I disagree with him a lot more, both on politics, but also about what the utility of this group is and on what terms they're providing value than I do the others. On the other hand, Peterson and Harris, and it's interesting that Harris thinks of himself not really as quite part of this thing, right? And Pinker, who I also think is good, thinks of himself as not quite part of this. And Peterson is more central to it. But I think those three are more thoughtful about these kinds of issues that we've been talking about. And I think that the more of that there is in this group, the more I think the group will become a positive and good thing. And the more it becomes, here we are, the ones other people, the progressive, regressives won't talk to, so we're talking to each other. And the more it becomes a kind of a thing that's focused on reacting against something that really is bad in the culture, but nonetheless, the more what they're doing is just reacting against that and banding together as reactionaries against it, the less valuable I think it'll be. So in a way, I liked, I think their individual shows got a little bit worse for a while, when they started seeing themselves as a unit. And now I think they're starting to improve and get past that. And I hope that that continues.
And there's a deliberate attempt to try to classify them politically as though this is just a political phenomenon. And in reading the stories about of Harris leaving Patreon and Peterson and Rubin talking about we need an alternative to this. The stories that are slanted critically of them. It's these are conservatives. They're the extreme right or something like that. And I think it was important and good in Harris's statement of leaving Petra. He doesn't agree with many of them politically, but still thinks there's a political bias. That's the likely explanation for why they're being removed from Patreon. And he doesn't want to be subject to the whims of that. And whims was his word, which is good. And that's the much deeper issue, that the best of these people have a real respect that the path to knowledge and truth is reason and the scientific method, and that the Enlightenment and the birth of modern science are high water marks in the pursuit of truth. And that something, and I don't think they have the real deep diagnosis of this, but a sense that something in the universities is going wrong in regard, and they're not teaching this anymore, and students are being miseducated. And I think that is a commonality to them, but it doesn't then translate that they have similar views politically or morally. And it's important for them to recognize that.
And I think it's important for them to stay that way. That is, I think to the extent that everybody in the intellectual dark web is a conservative or is a liberal, you know, as a left of center or whatever, however you define these things today, I think that hurts them. I think that actually having right now, given that their focus is on these Enlightenment values, it's hard to pigeonhole them. These articles try, but then Sam Harris comes back and says, no, I actually disagree with these people with this. So I think it's actually an advantage, given that none of them are going to have the right politics. Of course, if they're all objectivists, we'd have won already. So,
yeah, I mean, I'd like to see them have a more of a positive statement about what they're together on. That's not just opposition to some trend, and then it's a little hard to put one finger on exactly what the trend is. So I'd like to see whether it's the intellectual dark web or some organization that comes out of this. Someone say, like, we support this kind of conversation on these kind of terms, and have it like written out somewhere. This is our policy statement. We are an organization that's goal is to promote that. These clubs and organizations have signed on to this as we promote these ground rules for certain, you know, whatever. We put on events or shows that have these ground rules. And some specific set of values similar to, like, not necessarily the same one, but the University of Chicago released a statement about its policies towards speech on campus, something like that. And that could get support from the better people on a wide range of ideologies, and then really go out and try to get them, and try to get people with widely divergent political views, but who are, and ethical views and so forth, as we have from, you know, Peterson and others, but who are together on this one point that we can state positively, and then try to put on events that, you know, go by the truth. And
of course,
that,
it's hard because they do have such divergent views, philosophical views, or even views on things like free will, important philosophical issues that make it very difficult for them to actually define what it is that they agree on. All right, Ankur, you have the last word, and then we're gonna have to run because we'll.
Yeah, so I'll bring it back right to what we started with, that this is a deep issue. And that it has philosophical roots. I brought up the Evergreen State College and Brett Weinstein episode because I think it's very revealing in a number of ways, but in this way as well, that this is not primarily a political issue. He was, would have been regarded as a card-carrying member of the left. The idea of painting him as he had the wrong political values, or the painting him as a racist, I mean, there's a lot in his history where he's fought against racial discrimination, so on, that the opposition to him was much deeper than he's got the wrong politics. And that, it tells you something about what the forces at work here, that he wasn't falling in line, but not politically. He's asking questions and asking for arguments. And where's your argument for this position? What's your evidence for this? And it's, no, we don't want that. We don't think we need it. And so, and that's to go to your emotionalism. There's deep philosophical issues here that episode helps highlight, because you can't explain it politically.
Yeah, and it, from there, it really highlights all these episodes explained by, in a sense, the same kind of philosophical issues that came up at Evergreen. All right, thank you, Ankur. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.